Surging interest in seaweed. Seaweed is everywhere along the Gulf of Maine. The slippery plant-like algae grows on the rocks and under the water's surface. These days, seaweed's reputation is on the rise, with growing demand for different kinds of seaweeds as food and health products. Maine harvesters are turning to it as a plentiful, sustainable crop. And many fishermen are finding that it's a good way to augment their livelihoods. Last year, the seaweed harvest was worth almost $1 million, but its impact on the state approached $20 million. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Dulse, rockweed, and sugar kelp are just three kinds of seaweed harvested here. Researchers are actively looking for new uses for seaweed and new ways to grow it. What are your questions about this burgeoning industry? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Is seaweed the next big thing in Maine? Many people think so. They call it a superfood and a key crop for Maine's future marine economy. So what's the potential of seaweed? Joining me in the studio, Brianna Warner. She is CEO with Atlantic Sea Farms, and Tom Roth, co-owner and seaweed harvester with Vitamin C. And when I say vitamin C, it's vitamin SEA. Tom is also featured in a Maine Public video about seaweed harvesting, and you can find that on our Maine Calling Facebook page and on our website. And also joining us on the line for part of the show is Adam St. Gillet. He is Assistant Director for Science at the Institute for North Atlantic Studies and Assistant Lecturer with the UNE School of Marine Programs. As always, we want to hear from you in the audience. Do you eat seaweed or use seaweed-based products? Do you have questions about the different kinds of seaweed and how they're harvested? Or do you have a company that is using seaweed in some new and interesting way? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And welcome to all of you for this fun discussion on this gorgeous day. Tom, I want to start with you because you've sort of been in the business as it's grown from its infancy to what it is today. Characterize what seaweed harvesting and the seaweed business was like when you got into it and how it's changed.
Nothing's really changed on as far as how we do our process. I mean, we still do it manually. Everything's cut with a knife. Everything's hung to dry. The amounts have changed. Going from a small little skiff to now 14 skiffs, and we hire about 40 harvesters that work for us. They're all privately, on their own, but they sell to us.
Has what the demand is for the kinds of seaweed changed, or is it pretty consistent?
No, the demand is definitely in the uprise. Kelp is really really taken off, and then there's dulse that's probably one of the biggest sellers that we deal with.
So, okay, we're going to back up here, and you're going to give me the difference.
Dulse,
sugar kelp, and rockweed are the big three, right?
Yep. Rockweed, of course, by volume is the largest.
And rockweed is what a lot of people think of as seaweed. It's what's on the rocks if you go to the shore.
Right.
What's that used for?
So a lot of that's used for animal feed, and we harvest it for lobster and clam bakes. That's a big part of what we do also. We ship, they use it for shipping and packing lobster. And another part of it's for fertilizer, soil amendment.
Okay, so then the sugar kelp, I've always just called it kelp, but I've just learned that it's sugar kelp, is what's used in a lot of foods.
Yes, it's used in many different ways. As far as it's dried, or they pickle it and they freeze it now. I mean, so it's used in so many different areas.
And kelp is the one that looks like long lasagna noodles
Exactly. Going
down into the ocean. And then we've got dulse. Tell us about dulse.
So dulse is like a red ribbon. It's like maroon color, shorter plant, and it's got a totally unique flavor all to its own. I mean, it's quite incredible.
Okay. I want to bring Brianna, I want to bring you into the conversation. You grow sugar kelp at your company, right?
So not just sugar. There's a bunch of different types of kelp.
Really?
Yes. So we have sugar kelp and skinny kelp, but we actually don't grow. So Ocean Approved, which is the name of the parent company, We were the first commercial seaweed farm in the United States about 11 years ago. And now we actually don't grow at all, and we work with fishermen-turned farmers as a supplemental income source who are all growing seaweed all the way from Portland to Eastport. And so everything we do is line-grown, and it's several different species of kelp.
So the folks, and I wanted to ask you this as well, Tom, the folks who you're working with also fish in other seasons.
That's right. I mean, here on the coast of Maine, we basically have a lobster monoculture. There's very few options for people to diversify their income. You know, historically in Maine, people who fish for lobster also were shrimping and urchining and any number of other wild species. But right now, there's not that many options. So we actually work with fishermen to get leases and farm, which happens during the winter. We plant the seeds in November-ish, and we pull out of the water sometime by June. So it's countercyclical to the lobster season, and it provides a supplemental income source for fishermen. So yes, there are, almost all of them are fishermen that work with us.
And when you said 14 people harvesting for you, are you also talking about people who are fishing in other seasons?
Yes. Yep.
And that's how you started.
I was a commercial fisherman for 28 years.
Okay. And I want to go back to something you said, Bree, which was like you plant the seeds in November. I'm guessing you don't have divers go to the seafloor and plant seeds.
We don't. No, our kelp is all line grown, different than Tom's, in that we have long horizontal lines that sit about, you know, 4 to 10 feet under the water. And we have a large seed nursery that we produce seeds in Saco. And then we give them out to farmers, and they basically string them along the horizontal long lines. And then it grows like a weed until the summer when we harvest it.
How much has the company grown?
I took over the company in August of last year, and we have a whole new team, a whole new approach. We processed about 10 to 12 times more than we've ever processed before this harvest season.
In 1 year?
In
10
one
to
year.
12 times as much. Mm-hmm. Adam, I want to bring you into the conversation. Adam St. Gillet from UNE. I know there's a lot of excitement about seaweed as a sustainable product. What exciting to you from a scientific point of view?
Sure. I think from a scientific point of view, what's really exciting for me is just the vast swath of questions that we have in front of us to ask about growing seaweed. So if you think about, so we work primarily in farming seaweed, I should clarify that. But if you look at an example from terrestrial agriculture, corn, for example, humans have been growing corn for thousands of years. We have a pretty good idea of the best way to do that. But growing something like kelp in Maine, it's brand new. They've been doing it in other places for a long time. But farmers here are really interesting. They're effectively growing almost a wild seaweed. It's really one generation removed from a wild plant. So that just gives you an idea of sort of the swath of questions that you can ask from a scientific standpoint that's really exciting.
So we're talking about two different things. We're talking about farming seafood, and we're talking about harvesting wild seafood, wild seaweed. Tom, are you focusing on the wild?
Yeah, we're strictly wild at this point.
Do you worry that there's not enough, that it could be over-harvested like some fisheries have been?
Yeah, it's a big concern. That's why, you know, I got out of commercial fishing because of the sustainability, and I got into this because it was sustainable. And so we've been working the same beds now for about 17 years. And we found out by just leaving part of the stipe intact when we cut our kelp, like we can cut it in March if we need it early and go back in June and the plant is 6 foot again. So by cutting it the correct way, it'll just keep regrowing.
Tom, I understand you have nurseries at UNE. What are you looking at specifically in those nurseries? What are you trying to find out?
We have a nursery at the University of New England that we started actually 3 years ago, probably. And that was, it's a sort of a testament to how rapidly the industry has progressed in Maine. Whereas 3 years ago, people that wanted to get into farming were really limited in the places that they could get their kelp seed from. So we designed and built a nursery at the University of New England in hopes that we could help defray that pressure a little bit and help provide seed to farmers that were starting up. Fast forward now to just a few years later, and we feel like we served that purpose the way that we could, and we've backed away from that a little bit because companies like Bree's company are running nurseries in the commercial space. So the university didn't want to compete with the private sector in that regard. So now we're really focused on innovating, and our nursery really serves to supply our own farms. We have two research and demonstration farms in Saco Bay, just off our Biddeford campus.
Brianna, why are people so excited about seaweed from a product point of view? What kind of things do you believe are just going to really take off?
Well, any food that's going to take off has got to taste good, right? And I think people now are starting to recognize that seaweed is full of nutrients. I mean, it's got tons of iodine and vitamin D and vitamin B and omega-3s. And I mean, there's just so many health benefits with it. There's actually more calcium than milk per ounce. But that's all well and good. If it doesn't taste good, then who cares, right? You're not going to eat it. So I think people have started to make some really exciting products out of it that taste really good. You can get sea snacks right now that are, you know, kind of these salty little seaweed chips. They're imported, but they're really delicious. And you see them in almost every kid under 12 eats those in lunches, right? Costco is the third biggest importer of seaweed in the United States. We're not talking kind of a high-end sale, right? This is something that a lot of people are eating. So what we're doing is also creating products that are really delicious, like a seaweed-based kimchi or a seaweed-based sauerkraut or a fermented seaweed salad that gives you kind of all the health benefits and probiotics of fermentation, but then also tastes great, so you kind of want to eat it on everything.
So you're focused on food, but there are other products. I understand beauty products.
That's right. Yeah, we're focused entirely on food, so I can't speak as well to the other industries, but I think, you know, certainly for nutraceuticals and things like that, people are interested in the health benefits of seaweed because there's, you know, it's one of the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet. So people are using it for their health.
You use that word very quickly, nutraceutical.
Yeah, that's right. And we don't sell to that industry yet because, you know, we see such a demand in the food sector. So, you know, people are using it on their skin. There's tons of evidence that it's great for your skin. It's great for your animals. People are putting it in, you know, kelp and other seaweeds in their dog food. People are eating it on their plate every day. You know, we always say if you get 2 ounces of kelp a day, you're getting more of your nutrients than you could in any 2 ounces of any food. So there's a lot to it. And then making it taste good on top of that, because it is naturally good, but making it very easy for people to use is key in making sure that people are able to access it.
You know, Adam, I want to ask you about something. Just a couple weeks ago, Maine Calling focused on the warming waters in the Gulf of Maine. And I'm wondering if you're seeing that affect the kelp beds. And I'm going to ask you the same thing, Tom. Is there a you know, as we see the lobster population shift, are we also seeing the kelp shift?
Yeah, there's some really great work being done on the ecology of wild kelp beds, I believe, through the Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Sciences. From our perspective, what we've been seeing is, the way that we make baby seaweeds, like I said, really farmers are growing something that's one generation removed from a wild plant. And because of that, we, as people running nurseries, actually have to go out into the wild and find mom and dad kelp plants. And it's when you start your kelp nursery is really dependent on when the wild kelp populations decide to start making reproductive tissue. And what I've seen over the last few years is that it seems as that reproductive tissue is becoming available later and later in the season, which impacts how early I can start my nursery, for example, which then impacts how early I can get farmers their kelp seed. That's just one example, very anecdotal. But in the long run, I don't see the Gulf of Maine becoming a place that's inhospitable to seaweeds writ large and most of the kelp species that we have, too.
Okay. Are you seeing any shifts, Tom, based on the temperature of the water changing?
It's a fire. Yeah, I mean, we're seeing, for instance, I mean, the rockweeds growing twice as fast, it seems like, than it did 10 years ago. The warmer waters, you're seeing more regrowth. Like, if you look at a rockweed right now, it looks all yellow. Anything really yellow right at this time of the year is all new growth. So, I mean, it's growing faster than it normally would, being that the water's a little bit warmer. As far as like the kelps, the deep water kelps, you go 20 feet down. I mean, I dove yesterday to 35 feet and the water temperature was 47 degrees. So, you know, the surf temperature may show that's in the high 50s and low 60s, but you go down one atmosphere and it's pretty cold.
We're talking about seaweed, also known as sea vegetables, on Maine Calling. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainecalling.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. I'm going to read an email that came in before the program from Captain Sarah Weinberg at Cold Moon Sea Farm. She writes, I've been wild harvesting kelp for both personal and commercial harvest purposes for the past 10 years. And I've been growing kelp organically with Maine Sea Farms in Walpole for 5 years. And this is the first time I hold my own lease in my hometown of Bremen. I will be seeding my first crop of kelp this fall and harvesting March through May. Farming kelp brings community resilience on the coast of Maine. Kelp's remedial effect on ocean acidification has the potential to nourish many important wild fisheries while offering much needed winter work for seasonal laborers like myself. There is currently a bottleneck in the organic kelp farming industry. Kelp farmers have been growing high-quality product for over 20 years in the Gulf of Maine, but a low price per pound makes entering this industry difficult. Kelp farmers need a better price for their product. Consumers need ease of access to this nourishing food. As an industry, more high-quality value-added products featuring kelp as a key ingredient are needed. I hope that if any of your listeners are in product development and are inspired by the many exciting health, ecological, and social benefits of Maine-raised kelp, that they work on developing value-added products of their own. Do you all have thoughts on her thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I know Sarah, she's great, and she's doing some really interesting things. I think, you know, for us at Atlantic Sea Farms, one of the reasons that we work with fishermen, there are many reasons to work with fishermen, but one key reason is they have big boats already. They have a lot of gear. They know the water very well. And farming for them becomes actually fairly inexpensive. It's fairly easy to get into for them. It's fairly cheap to get into for them. And they can produce quite a bit of kelp pretty quickly and harvest it very well and quickly. So, you know, it's an interesting balance in this world. And I know that Tom does this as well, where you're trying to balance a low price point for the consumer, while at the same time making sure that, you know, everybody's making money. So it's you know, we're all kind of trying to figure this out. And what's really exciting is here in Maine, we're really on the forefront of that in American seaweed. And you know, it's a pretty tight-knit community. And it's pretty exciting to see that, you know, some people this year were able to, you know, spend 15, 16 days on the water and make double what they invested in their farm in the first year, which was really exciting.
Tom, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, if people seen how many times you have to handle this product, they would be, you know, I mean, it's handled so many times, from cutting it to bring it to the dock, unloading it, hanging it, drying it, rehydrating it, milling it, and then packaging it. I mean, so there's a lot of handling involved, but you know, we'd like to see that price point come down. We'd actually like to see it come up. You know, we're working with a federal grant right now on value added using kelp in breads. We received a grant last year actually for working with that.
All right, Adam St. Gelais, I understand you have to go because you're on the road. But before you do, I was wondering if there's anything you would like to add to this conversation about the future of seaweed in Maine.
Yeah, thanks. I think the future is bright. I'm glad we heard from Sarah. I know her as well. She's doing great stuff. But I think she hit the nail on the head. I think part of what is going to need to happen in the future is defining how that system is going to work in Maine efficiently and sustainably for Maine. So is that a future where we have many, many, many small kelp farms run by owner-operated individuals, or does it the nature of the kelp crop necessitate some sort of scale for sustainability? We sort of have yet to see that, but I think she is right in that innovating in the product space is really important. And she hit the nail on the head again, I think, with ingredients. You can extract all kinds of really valuable things from kelps, like proteins and plastics, nutraceuticals, biopolymers, but all of those things require a lot of infrastructure on the back end. So I think first things first, we're going to see a lot more innovative products in the food space.
All right. Well, Adam St. Gelais, Assistant Director for Science at UNE North. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from New England Cancer Specialists. Proud to be a member of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative and committed to helping patients achieve their best outcome. Evergreen Home Performance, a Marvin replacement contractor offering window and door replacement services. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Ocean View at Falmouth, committed to sustainability and dedicated to offering active retirement living with peace of mind for the future.
If you're a parent, you might have posted a lot of photos of your kids on social media, and your kids might not be so happy about it.
I don't really like it because, like, I didn't ask, and it's sometimes an embarrassing photo.
I'm Ari Shapiro. What parents may not realize when they post about their kids, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon between 4 and 6:30 on Maine Public Radio. Thank you for helping to keep public radio strong here in Maine. Our Let's Grow Together summer membership drive successfully wrapped up last Thursday morning. Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical are strong and well-positioned to do what they do each and every day into the months ahead, providing you with the best possible programming worthy of your support. Public radio wouldn't be public radio without your support, so thanks. Together, we raised over $250,000 and welcomed in 245 new members. Again, thanks for doing your part. It makes a difference.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, seaweed's growing role in Maine's economy. Joining me, Tom Roth, who is co-owner and seaweed harvester with Vitamin C, and Brianna Warner, CEO with Atlantic Sea Farms. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Robin Hadlock Seeley. She is with the School of Marine Science and Ocean Engineering at the University of New Hampshire, and she's the Chief Scientific Officer with the Rockweed Coalition. Thanks for calling in, Robin.
Hi, Jennifer. I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you. We've mostly been talking about the growth of kelp harvesting in Maine, but we did mention rockweed, and rockweed is another seaweed harvested here. There was a law passed in Maine a few months ago regarding what is and not legal to harvest in intertidal zones. Can you summarize the two sides of that debate and what the law now states?
Yeah, so just to repeat, we've been mostly talking about seaweeds that are farmed in Maine, like kelp. Rockweed, the seaweed that we mostly see on the shore when the tide goes out along the shores of Maine, it's strictly a wild harvest. And the legal question that we were working on over the last 4 years was who actually owns that seaweed, that rockweed, in the intertidal zone? Because in Maine, the intertidal zone is privately owned, the question came up, is the seaweed attached to it also privately owned, like the trees in your woodlot? And so after a long 4.5-year process, the answer came down in March of 2019 from Maine Supreme Court that the rockweed is, in fact, privately owned and that harvesters need permission from the landowner in order to come and harvest it. And that was a big change because most harvesters had been assuming that seaweed was like the clams in the mud and the mussels on the shore and the snails that climb along the shore, that it was a public resource. But the Maine Supreme Court said, no, this is a private resource and belongs to the landowner.
And why are you involved in this? As a marine scientist, what are your concerns about harvesting rockweed?
Well, from our point of view, the rockweed harvest is concerning simply because it is the bulk, the majority of the seaweed harvested in Maine. And in the last couple of years, over 95% of the by weight of the seaweed that's harvested in Maine is rockweed, is the species Ascophyllum nodosum. Now, the problem is that rockweed is also extremely important habitat to commercial fisheries like cod, like scallops, herring, and pollock, and a long list of species that people in Maine have traditionally fished for. And not only that, it's also important habitat for wildlife that we consider important, like shorebirds and eider ducks and puffins and herons. So it's really important that that harvest be ecologically sustainable. And the problem is the harvest has been going up dramatically in the last 10 or 12 years to the point where, as an organization, we're concerned that the harvest is not ecologically sustainable. And the reason is, is because although the biomass comes back, it does grow back. It never achieves the original height and stature. If you think of it like a forest, it never achieves the height of the forest that it had originally. All and right. Oftentimes, the cuts are repeated every 2 or 3 years so that the plant never gets to be back tall enough as it was before.
Well, Robin, thank you so much for calling in and joining the conversation. That's Robin Hadlock Seeley, Chief Scientific Officer with the Rockweed Coalition. Moving on now to Barry Costa Pierce, who is calling in from Iceland today. Barry is Executive Director of UNE North, and he is the Henry L. Grace Doherty Professor of Marine Sciences. Thanks for calling us, Barry.
Hi, Jennifer. It's a great delight. Thank you for the invitation. I never miss your show.
Thank you. I understand you're in Iceland with UNE's Ocean Food Systems students. Tell us how seaweed figures as a key ocean food.
Well, as you know, Jennifer, you know, Asian countries have used seaweeds for thousands of years for food. But we're just at the beginning of the seaweed bioproducts revolution worldwide. And so UNE, with its partner here at universities in Iceland, particularly the Iceland scientists, we're studying how the seaweed value chain is not only food. Yeah, food. We're looking at food. New ingredients and functional foods, you know, bioactive products benefiting human health and wellness. But we're also looking at the seaweeds in terms of the bioproducts probably can replace all single-use packaging that we use every day. And in the future, single-use plastics. So, you know, this sort of extraordinary plant that grows in the middle of the winter, you know, at low light, cold temperatures, doesn't need any exterior fertilization, no fresh water. And so these algae have potentially like a remarkable storehouse of products for human manufacturing and human health and wellness. So that's what we're doing. We're learning a lot of what you see here in Iceland and our European partners at UNE North. You're seeing that they're very far ahead in their thinking and their manufacturing, but they're real interested in man. So, you know, our objective is to see the next generation of these innovators, young people that were training in masters and PhDs.
Great.
Moving back and forth.
Barry, I want to ask you, if we're having this conversation 10 years from now, what do you think Maine seaweed potential is? What kind of dollars are we talking about?
Potentially tens of millions, virtually hundreds of millions of dollars.
Okay.
The reason why I'm so bullish is that we got to localize the value chain.
That's wonderful. We're having a little hard time understanding you. Okay. So I'm going to thank you and I'm going to say goodbye. That's Barry Costa Pierce, Executive Director of UNE North. Enjoy your travels, Barry. And I believe that he just said tens of millions or maybe hundreds of millions of dollars in 10 years. Bree, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need there's the food products, which Tom and I are mostly focused on. But as Barry said, I mean, there's possibilities of using seaweed as plastics. At the London Marathon this year, the all of the water was delivered to the runners in seaweed pouches. I mean, the idea that we could be farming and harvesting the seaweed from here in Maine is, I mean, the possibilities are somewhat endless with all the things that you can do with seaweed. It turns into thickening agents in your toothpaste. It can be made into plastics. It can be made into food. It can be made into skincare. And so I think, you know, I Barry is right on the money with that. And I will just kind of a plug for his program. I mean, there's also kind of this burgeoning group academics focused on seaweed here in Maine that can help contribute to the industry in a huge way. We just hired actually someone from his program who's running our seaweed nursery this year with our supply manager. We're working with Bigelow Laboratories here on the coast of Maine to study the effects of ocean acidification, remediation of ocean acidification by planting seaweed. And there's just so much knowledge here on the coast of Maine. We're really, it's this opportunity we have to be first movers in just about every way. I don't know, Tom, if that's kind of what you're seeing, but it just feels like we're really on the edge here of something really dynamic here in Maine that can be Maine focused.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, the seaweed you know, the uses of seaweed is changing every day. It's just not what, you know, a slimy substance that we're all used to seeing laying on the beach. I mean, you know, look beyond that. And it's in so many of our products that we use today that people don't even realize it.
We have an email from Paul. If someone just wants to go out and collect some kelp for themselves to eat, is that allowed? And are there any cautions about how to prepare it so that it's edible?
Well, you know, after a storm, usually you'll see fronds of kelp laying along the shore. And really, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you know, you rinse it back off in the salt water, you take it home, you either freeze it or like what we do, we don't freeze anything. Everything's hung to dry. So we would just hang it up and dry and then use it, you know. But finding stuff along the shore after a storm is fine. And there used to be allowed, every state Maine resident was allowed 40 pounds of any type of seaweed every day. And they were allowed to go down to the beach and collect it. Now that we're having this intertidal zone battle, that's all changing. But it used to be a public trust right for every person who lived in Maine to collect up to 40 pounds of seaweed a day.
As far as preparing it goes, I mean, if you blanch it in water, it turns kind of that bright green that we're all used to, I mean, without the additives. And it knocks off a lot of that kind of salty flavor. And then you can put it in anything. We put it in salads. We put it in desserts. I mean, it can go in anything. It's a very neutral product once blanched.
So when you say blanch it, you bring your water to a boil, put it in, it turns bright green. Pull it out and rinse it.
Quick. And you can use it in, I mean, quite literally, just about anything. People use it in carrot cake. People use it in ice creams. People use it as 2 ounces on a salad, as a bed for their fish. I mean, it can be used in really cool ways.
Great. We're going to go to Beth in Harmony. I think she has a related question. Hi, Beth. Go ahead.
Hi. Is this another great show that you've got? I was calling to ask about specific nutritional values. I've been using various seaweed, sea vegetables for about 20 years, and I've always had a hard time finding specific nutritional values for the different kinds of sea vegetable. Like, for instance, which has more iron, the kelp or the dulse, you know, or which has more magnesium and that sort of thing. I was wondering if Brianna, you had something, or if University of New England had done some research on where can I find this info? Because I can't even find it on the internet yet.
So I think one thing that you'll be seeing is there's more of us that are going into consumer packaged goods now. So you can actually go to the store and buy this stuff. And as a requirement of putting out anything that you can buy in a retail store, you actually have a full nutrition panel. So everything that Tom sells, everything that I sell, everything that Maine Coast Sea Vegetables up in Hancock, who does beautiful products, sell, all have this nutrition data. And you can kind of do a side-by-side, and they're all listed on most of our websites as well. So I would encourage you to look at those. I mean, there is some variability. It is wild. Even the stuff that we're growing online does come from a wild source. But, you know, you can find some general rules on the nutrition panels and compare and contrast from there.
Right. And you could also go to the MaineSeaweedCouncil.org, and they list a breakdown of all the nutrients and just about all the sea vegetables that we have here in Maine.
Beth, thanks for your call. We'll go up to Belfast and Ferris. Hi, Ferris. Go ahead.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I always get a little anxious when we discover a new natural product that's going to solve all our problems. And I'm excited to hear, I mean, I realize it's got many advantages, but I also worry because when we're harvesting, especially from the wild or even farming, that monoculture farming, we think we're sustainable because we're replanting either the kelp or the trees or whatever, but what we're replacing or sometimes disrupting is a very diverse ecosystem where many, many species live. And for instance, the seals at the top of that ecosystem spend a lot of time foraging and sheltering in the kelp forests. Do we truly know what we're disturbing? And how can we avoid some unintended consequences of this harvesting and agriculture in the waters? So
sure.
That's my question.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Ferris. And I think many people share your concerns. We We don't have a scientist left with us, but we have someone who spent 25 years in the water. Go ahead.
So as far as over-harvesting, it's very possible, right? I mean, it happened with the urchin industry here in Maine. And I mean, so, but if you're in this industry for the long haul, you're not going to over-harvest. You got to pay attention. You know, you got to know what to take, how much to take, leave the larger plants down below. I mean, you know, what we're harvesting is basically what we can reach at low tide. If you step off and dive down another 10 feet, there's a whole nother bed down there that are feeding the urchins, that are feeding the fish that we're not even touching. So, I mean, the kelp goes down to about 60, 70 feet and it's really thick, but no, we're not going that far to touch it. So the regrowth is there.
And from the farm angle, I mean, I think we do know some of the positives it's doing, which is, you know, mitigating the effects of ocean acidification. So think about that around a mussel farm or around, anything where there's shellfish. There's some major positive effects. And I think I will just say something that you said in your question is, you know, the thing that's going to save the world. And I think with kelp in particular, with seaweed in particular, it's easy to kind of overblow what this is going to do for people, right? This is a crop that is doesn't use any inputs. It's regenerative. It helps the water. It filters the water. It also remediates ocean acidification. It provides alternative income sources for people. You don't use any additives or chemicals or fertilizers. It's good for the consumer. It's about as good as it gets. I don't envision a world where we have a seaweed farm in every single town in Maine and elsewhere along every coast of the United States. But, you know, each one we put in is making a markedly better effect than before it was there.
Ferris, thanks so much for your call and joining the conversation. We are going to take another quick break. We're talking about seaweed. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling. With help from Maine State Music Theater, presenting The Wizard of Oz, August 7th through the 24th. Tickets online at msmt.org. Lamy Wellahan Shoes, committed to reducing greenhouse gases at all their locations throughout Maine, because what's good for the environment is also good for business. And New England Forestry Foundation, celebrating 75 years of conserving forests for future generations. Learn more at newenglandforestry.org.
On the next Speaking in Maine, will there be a regime change in Venezuela?
You cannot have an absolutist policy in terms of how you deal with people whose help you need to get things done.
Dr. Susan Purcell is an independent consultant on Latin America. She spoke at the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations in Northport about possible solutions to the political turmoil in Venezuela. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Monday afternoon at 2, here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, harvesting seaweed in Maine and what it means for our economy. Joining me, Tom Roth with Vitamin C and Brianna Warner with Atlantic Sea Farms. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Joining me online now is Nick Brancina. He is Associate Director of Fisheries and Aquaculture with Coastal Enterprises, Inc., or CEI. Thanks for joining us, Nick.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tell us about the work you've been involved with to support the seaweed industry, both financially and technically.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And again, I would just reiterate that for the most part, we're focusing on the aquaculture or the farming of it. It's been our primary focus. I mean, essentially, we are optimistic that aquaculture in its many forms presents opportunities for job growth in Maine and sustaining our working waterfronts and can represent potential for people to stay there, stay in the business, in other words, supplement fishing and diversifying income and diversifying time on water. We love sea vegetables because it's more of a counter season to harvest it. In other words, it's in the wintertime, whereas a lot of shellfish growth, lobstering, commercial fishing is obviously a little more robust in the summer and spring months, and that, you know, cultivating and harvesting seaweed is a good off-season kind of low kind of entry point to actually make some money and stay on the water. So at CEI, we've been trying to help finance those folks that are trying to get in or, more ideally, expand operations whether it be shellfish or seaweed.
All right. Well, speaking of trying to help, tell us about the Sea Farm Loan. How does that work?
Oh, yeah, great. The Sea Farm Loan is designed to help those that may want to ideally expand their operation but have faced some declination from commercial lenders or banks. That's where CEI sort of comes in and is able to do a little bit more creative financing, we hope, and allow, you know, kind of take that barrier of financing away and let those that are you know, really committed to this type of farming and are serious about it to get the kind of capital they need to do multiple things, whether it's purchasing gear, getting operating capital, if they're doing value-added products and they need a construction loan, acquiring land. I mean, there's multiple facets of farming. It's not just necessarily going to be on the water, as Brianna knows very well.
All right. Well, Nick, thanks so much for joining us. That's Nick Brancina, Associate Director of Fisheries and Aquaculture with CEI. We're going to go to Peter calling from the Mid-Coast. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Jennifer. I'm just wondering, you know, the waterfront, the working waterfront, you know, has gone through vast changes over the past couple decades. And I'm wondering if, you know, the volumes of seaweed-related products that are now being landed are having any effect and perhaps, you know, creating interference for other landings that are done routinely. I may be off base in suggesting that's happening. A second question I have, you know, has ownership really, you know, been resolved in terms of who's got a stake in the seaweed? And if that stake is in private hands, you know, is there going to be now arbitration or something so that the private owner and the industry, you know, can work out something equitable that's, you know, acceptable by both sides? Finally, the whole idea of the Skudik Institute, the Down East Institute, you know, I heard mention of Bigelow Labs being engaged. I'm just curious, are the other two I just mentioned also engaged? And if not, why not? I think it would be, in terms of the education and outreach elements of this, I think it would be a perfect fit. Thanks.
Okay, so I'm going to try to remember all of these, and I'm going to start with you, Tom, and ask you, are you seeing an impact being a former commercial fisherman and now working in the seaweed industry? Do you think the one is affecting the other in terms of productivity?
Well, first of all, there's not very many commercial fishermen left, unfortunately.
For groundfish.
Right. Yeah, groundfish in the state of Maine. But as far as places to land and unload your seaweed, right now it hasn't been a problem. We have a couple of docks that we lease to do our landings and our unloading. And it's, like I said, a lot of it's just mom and pops. It's a lot of small people that come in with a small truckload that has their own little greenhouse. They do their own little thing. They dry it. Every couple of weeks, we show up and pick up their, you know, what they have harvested. And so it's a small industry.
Okay. And then following up on his question, I'm curious about, now that the Supreme Court decision has been handed down, what is going on the ground? Are individual harvesters approaching landowners and getting permission? And have there been, has there been strife, or has it been pretty orderly since, I believe it was April?
You know, when this law came out, the first thing I did is I called the wardens and said, what do I need to do? And they said, do exactly what you've been doing. You've never had a problem. If a landowner came up to us and said, look, you know, we kind of like the way things look in front of our house, we move 300 feet. It's not a big deal. You know, we're not there to displease anyone. We've had landowners come up and ask us to remove all the seaweed, which we couldn't do. We can't do either. So, you know, does the landowner own it? Can he strip the seaweed in front of his house because he doesn't like it? I mean, that if they own it, they can do what they want with it. So this is another problem that no one's even looking into. So, but, you know, as long as you're courteous and there's enough ledges out there that are not owned by any landowner, and, you know, and you work along with them, we have no problems.
And do any of you all know if Skudik is becoming involved in this? We don't know at this point. Yeah, we don't. If you're with Skudik Institute and you're listening to the show, give us a call. We're going to go to Josh calling from Portland. Hi, Josh. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having me. And hey, Tom and Brianna. I am the owner of Heritage Seaweed, which is an all things seaweed shop in Portland, Maine. So we're right down on India Street. And we opened over a year ago, and we just wanted to showcase all of the stuff that you're talking about, all these amazing divergence of new products, all in one place. Because what we've realized over the past few years being involved in Maine seaweed is that, in general, people are really excited about it, really interested in it. But they, a lot of people don't have the opportunity to try all this stuff. So if anyone wants to try any of these products, feel free to come on down to the shop. But
Josh, I want to ask you, how old is your shop? How long have you been around?
Yeah, we just celebrated our first birthday. We opened July 1st last year.
And how's it going?
It's going great. Yeah, this summer is like twice what we were doing last summer. We're having a great time, and people are coming back, and people are really excited. So it's great. And it's great to be kind of on the front lines of it every day, talking to the general public and figuring out, you know, what are their questions, what are their interests, and what are they looking for in terms of products. But I just wanted to comment sort of on Sarah Weinberg's point, and congratulations to her for starting her farm. But yeah, there's, you know, it's an exciting time because we're right at, you know, at the beginning of kind of the next wave of this industry. So things are naturally going to have these fits and starts, but Sarah's right about the bottleneck in terms of, you know, right now, if you start a farm, there are all these programs that help people start farms, which is great. But then the question is, what do we do with it? And, you know, how do we make money off of it and things like that? And what I would like to see is the state of Maine. And there's a few organizations like Island Institute and CEI, which just called in, which do a lot of great work in supporting farmers, getting their farms in the water. But we also need to do a lot more around marketing. Marketing specifically that Maine seaweed brand, because it is already and can be more of a brand.
Josh, thanks so much.
A lot more going on with that.
Thanks so much for calling in and joining the conversation. I'm going to move in. We have so many calls coming in and so little time. I'm going to move on to Rob in Rockport. Hi, Rob. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. Great program. I was a sea urchin diver in the 90s. And I dove everywhere from Portland all the way up to MDI area. And my observation when I started in the early 90s is that, guess what? There really was no seaweed in the intertidal area. The sea urchins were everywhere. They basically, there were carpets of these things, just munching all the seaweed away. And we were always looking for sea urchins that might be in some bed of seaweed. Well, where's the seaweed? It was very hard to find. And when we did find it, that's where the good sea urchins were. So the sea urchin industry got its foot in the door by essentially removing sea urchins out of the ecosystem. And that's what they wanted to see happen. So then seaweed would grow. And then the seaweed did, over the course of 10 years, start to really grow. And we had kelp, you know, 20 feet tall, in places where the sea urchins now were not in abundance. Mm. And so seaweed became, you know, it's everywhere. And so when I hear people say that, that it could be over-harvested, seaweed could be over-harvested, I think it could. But what was happening is the sea urchins were harvesting and eating the seaweed, so it wasn't really around. And sea urchins can live on just sediments. They don't need seaweed to survive. But it is their preferred food. So I think we made a huge ecosystem change just by harvesting all the sea urchins away.
Interesting.
Seaweed is now, lobstermen were very happy to see the sea urchins go away because that gave the lobsters habitat. And so I think a lot of people who are new in this, who are just looking at it in the last 5 to 10 years, have to recall or know that sea urchins were pretty much taking out the seaweed. They didn't give it a chance to grow.
Rob, thanks so much for calling with that perspective. Go ahead, Brianna.
I think Rob makes an interesting point about the ecosystem, but I also want to go back to something that Tom said earlier that seems to be kind of this theme. When we talk about seaweed's explosion or whatever it is that we want to call it, we're talking about an explosion from nothing. This is a very, very small industry. And the idea that there would be, you know, some sort of conflict in any way with these other species out there? I mean, first of all, it's a lot of commercial fishermen who are the ones who do the seaweed harvesting anyway, seaweed farming and on the harvesting side. But as a second point, I mean, this industry is so small, and I can't recall the numbers directly off the top of my head. But, you know, the New York Times ran an article earlier this April, and this is just for farmed seaweed, that mentioned that there was about 40,000 pounds of farmed kelp harvested last year. And this year it's a little over 300,000 through the state, right? So we're talking a micro industry. And I just kind of wanted to get that in there because I think that it's, again, we can say seaweed's everywhere, but it's really, you know, seaweed is everywhere, but 98% of it actually comes from Asia. And it often is adulterated with, you know, heavy metals because it's grown in not great areas. There's high cadmium and lead and all that other stuff. We in the coast of Maine are harvesting it from clean, cold waters, and we're making an industry. But it remains very small and has a long way to grow before it really makes an impact.
I agree. I'm sorry. I agree.
Yeah, Rob, thanks so much for your call. We're going to go to Sebastian from the Maine Aquaculture Association. Sebastian, you have about 30 seconds, but I really appreciate you calling in. Go ahead.
No worries, Jennifer, and thank you again for such a wonderful show. You have yet again assembled a cadre of experts in the field. I just want to make the point that it is an amazing connection between a series of traditions in Maine. We have the traditions of the working waterfront. We have the traditions of an incredible foodie and culinary tradition, and we have the traditions of entrepreneurship and small companies building to be bigger companies. And that is really what's happening in the seafood business right now. It is quite unusual nationally, and Maine is leading the way. And I just send out my kudos to all the entrepreneurs and people who are risking capital and time and effort in this business. And again, Jennifer, thank you so much for having the show. I think it's a great show.
Sure. And thank you so much for calling in. And that, Sebastian, you're our last call today. Thank you to our guests here in the studio, Bree Warner, CEO with Atlantic Sea Farms, and Tom Roth, co-owner and seaweed harvester with Vitamin C. You can see Tom at work by going to our Facebook page or our website, a video from about 4 years ago, but still pretty good. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Ella Boyd took your calls. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.